Hello and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and I am thrilled today to offer part two of my conversation with Kathleen Dean Moore. Kathleen Dean Moore is a philosopher, an environmental advocate, and she's an award-winning nature writer. Part one of our conversation, we aired back first on February the 22nd. It was called Earth's Wild Music, and it was after one of her more recent book titles, Earth's Wild Music. If you go to the KPTZ website, go to Nature Now on the podcast tab, and you can search for Earth's Wild Music or Kathleen Dean Moore, and I would certainly encourage you to listen to part one. Part two, we're going to be talking about how philosophers view some of the challenges, and we'll focus primarily on a second very recent book that Kathleen has written called Take Heart. And I do want to encourage listeners to do a couple of things. One, to listen to part one of the conversation. The second thing I would recommend is going to the Jefferson Land Trust website, Google Kathleen Dean Moore, and you can find her talk to the Land Trust Conservation Breakfast, which happened in March. And the title of her talk was First, Fall in Love, What It Means to Love a Place. And then the third thing I want to bring to people's attention is the website for what's called the Spring Creek Project of the Oregon State University. And on there, there are a number of recordings that Kathleen Dean Moore calls animal interludes, which are artful combinations of readings from her book, Earth's Wild Music, and various kinds of musical accompaniment. Also on the Oregon State University Spring Creek Project website, there's a longer presentation. It was filmed on a concert stage and in some of the Northwest wonderful landscapes. It's called Extinction Variations, and it's set to a classical pianist performance of Sergei Rachmaninoff's Variations on a Theme by Corelli, and that weaves a lot of Kathleen Dean Moore's words and carries the words and the emotions from the music together. So I would encourage all of those things as resources for hearing more about Kathleen Dean Moore's philosophical perceptions of some of the dilemmas we're in. But today's conversation is going to be about her most recent book called Take Heart, Encouragement for Earth's Weary Lovers. We all know, and we talked in our earlier conversation, how easy it is to be overwhelmed or disheartened or depressed or sapped of energy and hard to find impetus to act in defense of the world, but that it requires moral integrity to act. And Kathleen's book, she describes it as written for broken-hearted activists, veterans of environmental struggles, as a thank you gift to people who are tired, perplexed, and battered from all directions. It's not a eulogy and it's not an obituary. It is an inspiration. And it's a very interesting, I don't want to call it structure, but it's a very interesting creation. There are short essays about specific action, each with a piece of art. And the art's not pretty. It's quirky and it's thought-provoking and it's tragic and it's comedic at the same time. So I want to ask Kathleen about the role of art in opening our eyes and our hearts to the beauty of our world and the maybe tragedies of our world. What can art bring that is so important?
You know, Nan, I think that we're in a situation where the facts that are presented to us, the predictions scientists are making, the things we see with our own eyes, are so horrible that we look away.
Yes.
We can't bring ourselves to look directly at them, or it turns us to immobility. It paralyzes us. Mm-hmm. So many problems, so intertwined, so complex.
And so big.
So big that we are turned to stone. And I think back in the history, I think there's another story about being turned to stone, and that is the story of Medusa. You remember Medusa, the terrible gorgon with the snake hair? So formidable, so terrifying, that if a person were to look directly into her face, they would be turned to stone. So as the story goes, this hero named Perseus, equipped with winged sandals and a magic sword and a magic reflective shield, came upon Medusa, but rather than looking directly at her, he turned his reflective shield in her direction, and looking at the reflection in the shield, he reached out and cut off her head. So I think that in these times, faced as we are with the Medusa of problems, that our magic reflected shield is art. That what art allows us to do is see, in some ways, a representation of the situation we face in such a way that we can look at it directly and act. So our hearts can be opened without being broken. So what does art do? Art shows us a representation of the situation in such a way that we are carried towards action to try to fix the situation as well as we can. The music that you mentioned, and I thank you for talking about the music that I have done to try to present these ideas, in particular, interests me. There's a reason why we created these tiny concerts, that because music carries meaning, it carries this unmediated meaning straight into your heart. I mean, there's a reason why children dance to music. There's a reason why soldiers march to music. There's a reason why we make love to music and why we bury our dead with music. And that's because music is the trembling of the air. And we can resonate with that, literally that. Music can match and magnify our own trembling and bring it into harmony and concert with the great pulse of being. So if we can attach our ideas as philosophers to the music, they can sail, as it were, into the human spirit the way that music can do it. But as you point out in this book, we're talking about visual art. That also, I think, is extraordinarily insightful. Bob Haverluck, the artist for this book, is a very smart and knowing man, a wonderful artist, but also a quite remarkable theologian. So what we're doing when we're bringing this art and the words together is bringing philosophy and theology together in a book. An example is his drawing of a cartoon of a broken flower. Do you remember that?
Oh, I remember that so well.
Here you have a woman holding a flower in front of her, and as you look closely, you see that the stem of the flower is just broken. So someone has overlapped the stem and tied it up with a piece of string. So, Nan, tell us the caption on that drawing.
Well, thank you, Kathleen, because I was so struck by that drawing. You know, I didn't see the broken stem at first, and then it took just kind of that extra moment to go, oh, yes. And there's hope that somebody has tied it back together again. And the woman is still intrigued and enjoying the view of that flower. And the artist put a caption to that particular drawing, and it says, "If you believe the watery earth can be healed, you believe too much. If you think it can't, you believe too little."
Bob knows that there's tragedy in believing too little. We can't let our moral imagination go weary and withered. And there's tragedy in believing too much. We can't escape the consequences of our act. This is the age of reckoning with those beliefs that don't match the world. Bob says that the work of art is to gobsmack. Gobsmack. It's a wonderful word. It comes from the Scottish and the Irish Gaelic. A gob in their slang is a mouth. And you know smack. So that if you say you were gobsmacked, it means that you were so surprised or astonished that you clapped your hand over your mouth. And he says, if we really saw the world we live in, we would be, he says, on our knees or on dancing feet, seeing hymns of hurrah. And that's what he's trying to create.
And his drawings, too, they allow you to hold several almost conflicting thoughts at once and be glad. and joyful.
That's what he's trying to create. Yeah. Not these painful explorations of the philosopher, but this sudden seeing. Along with gobsmacked, we should introduce the word astonishment too, because it's a wonderful word but has the same sort of violence to it. That astounds come from the word of thunder, tonus, lightning and thunder. And so astonishment is a way of viewing the world that is like being struck by lightning. Like being struck by lightning and reduced to kind of a fearful, awe-stricken kind of wonder and fear. So if we truly saw, he's trying to help us truly see, we would understand how astonishing the world is.
And I can't help also but think about gratitude. Once you realize that, and once you are astonished, or once your attention is grabbed and you're paying attention, obvious next place as I go is gratitude for what I'm seeing and what I'm experiencing and what the world is giving me. How do you think about gratitude in the sense of our dying earth?
Yeah, right. You know, I've been thinking a lot lately about whether it's possible to be grateful and sad at the same time.
Yes.
I'm not sure. I think it is impossible, but I'm going to go for a walk with a friend of mine soon who has lost her husband, and I'm going to ask her that. In a time of terrible sorrow, if you open your mind to the great gifts of the earth, is it helpful? Does it help us turn our hearts toward joy, even in a time of terrible sorrow? I think so. The point about gratitude is, well, let me tell you a story. I was in BC on the edge of a salmon stream. There was this big Sitka spruce, and in a circle around the base of the Sitka spruce, grizzly bears had deposited spawned out salmon, almost like a necklace around the tree, almost as if they were laying breakfast down for the pine martens. And this circle of giving, the circle of returning, watching that skin of those salmon shiver with the maggots underneath them, waiting to be eaten in order to nourish the land again in that Sitka spruce, all I could think of was these great cycles that the earth turns with these great cycles of giving and taking and giving in turn. That's what makes the world go round, is that kind of reciprocity of gifts. And if we break those cycles, then we break the great act of the world. So there's moral consequences to the story that I'm trying to tell you about the bears, is that if we think about all the gifts that the earth gives us, fresh air, water, rain, soil, this great abundance, I don't know why the gift gives those to us. Let's let that be a mystery. But what is important is that they are given constantly, whether we know them or not. Every breath we take, every drink we take, are given to us. And that gift-giving calls us to gratitude, which is this glad appreciation for the worth and the generosity of the gifts. And so by receiving these gifts, we enter into this community of mutual sharing. We enter into a community of giving and celebrating and using and giving in return. So that notion of giving gifts in our turn is the key, I think, to the moral obligation that gratitude gives us, is that we reciprocate for the gifts that we have been given when we use our gifts, when we use our gifts well for the benefit of the earth and the inhabitants who depend on them. So it's the giving of the gifts and the receiving of the gift and the accepting of this community of returning the gifts that is the root of our moral obligation to the past, which has given us this gift, and our moral obligation to the future, to leave a world as rich in possibilities as the world that was given to us. So I think there's a great direct line between the joy and nourishment we get from the gifts of the earth to our obligation to give gifts in return.
Mm-hmm.
The wonderful Potawatomi elder, Robin Kimmerer, calls it, of course, reciprocity, returning the gifts.
I ponder why just the act of thankfulness gives me peace.
It's part of the cycles of life. We are entering into this great exchange that allows life to continue and evolve.
I wonder about whether gratitude leads to action. I think you just said absolutely it does, because you have an obligation to continue that cycle.
we do, we have an obligation to keep the circle spinning. And keeping the circle spinning is going to avert these environmental calamities and leave a world just every bit as rich as our own.
And I was thinking a lot, too, about our earlier conversation about hope, despair, and finding the place in between, the place of moral integrity, and acting from there. And I think gratitude can be a really powerful place in the middle, to be able to think about our world and to think about actions and to think about our role.
You know, you asked about peace. Why does gratitude bring us peace? I think it's because our discomfort, our sense of not having peace, is because of our continual taking and asking and wanting and feeling we need and accumulating more and more and more that makes us crazy. And where does peace come from? Peace comes in understanding that the world gives us enough, that mm-hmm. our great gifts are enough, and that we can be, as you say, at peace with that. These gifts come to us. We don't earn them. We don't earn the fresh water. We don't earn the fresh air. It's given to us. We don't deserve them. If they were taken away, there's nothing we could do to get them back. And yet they come. There is peace in that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Reassurance and a sense of obligation that comes from being a part of that circular giving and giving again.
Many of us struggle with the forlornness of the state, and we talked earlier about don't slip into despair or don't slip into unfounded hope. I mean, my heart has been broken any number of times. I think about having been driven through miles and miles and miles of what had been healthy jungle ecosystems in Indonesia. And now in Indonesia, there are over 30 million acres that were devastated and converted into palm oil plantation to serve the demands, quote unquote, needs certainly not, but demands of modern societies. But in addition to the land, it was the just extremely desperately poor farming families you could see along this dirt road. And then thinking about the surviving orangutans who used to live in that habitat. And they are just huddled in a few strips of riparian habitat, struggling for existence. And then closer to home, we see orcas starving, and they're too weak to swim or they're too weak to reproduce, largely due to lack of salmon, which is, you know, a combination of forest destruction, pollution, warming streams, changing hydrologic seasons, and or having a belly full of human-made plastic waste. It's hard to forget that time in 2018 when a grieving mother orca up in our area carried her dead baby, nudging it continually towards the water surface, and was over 2 weeks before she finally gave up. How heartbreaking that was. And there are times when I wonder, How is it even possible to heal one's heart from hurts that are so big?
Yeah. Heal your heart? That I don't know. Hold this pain in your heart. That I understand. You know, let your heart expand to hold it all.
Ah.
You think your heart will burst? I don't think so. I think when you allow your heart to expand, to hold all this pain, what you find is a deeper empathy. And that allows you to understand that in this world, all hurt is mutual. Any hurt mm-hmm. is all our hurt. And all thriving is mutual. That all thriving depends on the thriving of each. And so I think that this expanded heart can lead us to, as I say, a new empathy. And that is a good thing.
I'm gobsmacked by that, actually. That feels so much better to think about it that way and to allow those hurts that are real to reside, but to open further.
Oh, no, the structure of the human heart. I've seen pictures of it. I have never held a human heart or any heart in my hand. But I imagine that there's lots and lots of room in that heart.
Yeah.
That there's lots of space for that heart to expand.
You talk a bit in your book, Take Heart, about how we handle outrage. I mean, I could be outraged at those palm oil plantations. And yet I know, as much as I try, I use products that have palm oil in them. And I think about salmon, and I enjoy salmon. I try to always buy it direct from the fisherman that has been in Alaska. So some of that outrage might be directed at myself, but also some of it's kind of directed at that larger corporate entity, or that larger corporate greed, or the larger societal greed that I know I'm a part of. But how do you think about that? How do you wander your way philosophically through that dilemma?
Well, let me start out with a parenthetical point, is that if you do direct the anger at yourself, that is exactly what big oil wants you to do. These multi-million dollar campaigns to make you think that you are responsible, even to make you think that it's a consumer-driven thing.
Right, and they're doing the best thing, and they're, yeah.
Yeah, even as they are outsourcing their guilt on you. I confess that people often, in fact, I should say every time I give a talk, somebody is going to criticize me for being so angry. Look at what I'm angry at. Here we have corporations who are gouging the earth and gouging the people, and in the process creating the greatest violation of human rights this world has ever seen. I don't think that's an overstatement. You look at the facts. By 2050, 1 billion people, one out of every people on earth, will be driven from their homes by flood and drought and starvation. Why? So that some people can get extraordinarily rich. And that children are sickened by particle pollution and carcinogens in the air, and aquifers are poisoned by fracking and in injecting chemicals that are usually used to kill insects or clean toilet bowls or strip paint or polish brass. All these chemicals, the chemicals we use to preserve corpses and commit murder, arsenic, are being injected into our aquifers. And I'm not supposed to be angry about that. People say, you know, you should be more understanding, you should be more empathetic. These oil barons are caught in the system and they're just doing their job. Well, let me point out that refusing to participate in wrongdoing on a cosmic scale is an option open even to people who are wearing gold cufflinks. That each one of us can say, this is wrong and I won't participate. And then you and I, we, and the people who are listening can say something even better. We can say, this is wrong. This is wrong, and I won't allow it.
Which brings me back around to your book, Take Heart, because you've got a set of fairly simple statements of actions, like take a stand. Are there actions in that list that you think are really the most important ones, or should we be following all of them? I guess I'm also curious about how you organized the book that way, what inspired you to approach it the way you did. But let's talk about the actions first.
We had a number of drawings that Bob had done, and many of them I wrote essays to go with them, to speak to the points that he was making. And then in other cases, I had essays that I had written, and he did drawings that went with them. And we organized them in pairings, one drawing and one essay each, and gave each caption, like, open your heart to grief, or stand up for what you think is right, or never quit. And I can't say that these things are actions in the sense of anything in particular. They all kind of focus on one point, and that is that people are always asking me, what can one person do? You know, here I am, me. Mm-hmm. Against all of these forces of evil and destruction, what can one person do? And my answer always is, you can stop being one person. You can join up with other people and make a difference. One person, when you go into a city council meeting, a councilman told me, is dismissed. Two people are worrisome. Three people are a movement.
Yes. You know, I don't think of them as actions like recycle your plastic. I think they're so much more powerful than that, because they're actions that change perception, that change ways of thinking, that change ways of seeing one's place in the world. And I think that's one of the reasons that the book spoke so strongly to me is it wasn't just this sort of laundry list of do this, do this, that, and the other. It really talked about, as you said, just sort of basic approaches.
So such things as take a stand, know you're not alone, get in the way.
I like get in the way, yes.
All these things. We come down then to number 10, and that's where I kind of stuck, because it says love fiercely and forever. And I think that if you were to ask me which of these I think is probably the most fruitful, the one that's probably most important is that one. Number 10, love fiercely and forever. We love the world. That's a basic fact. This struggle for it is a love story. We might think that loving is a kind of la-di-da. We might think that loving is just a way of being happy, but it is not. Loving is a kind of work. Sometimes it's hard, spirit-testing work. And to love a person, to love a place, both of them, are to pledge your life to its thriving and to work, as I say, fiercely and faithfully to protect them from harm for all time. We all look for the motivation that's going to get us out of our chair and doing something. I don't think we have to look any farther than our hearts. We love this world, and we're losing it on our watch.
I think that is a wonderful place to end our conversation. That message is the resonant one that I want to leave our listeners with. Thank you.
I've certainly appreciated your deep reading of my books and your deep listening to the music.
Goodbye, and I hope to meet you again one of these days and talk more.
I would look forward to that. Thanks, Nan. Be well.
You as well. Bye. I want to end today's reflections of a philosophical nature with an excerpt from Kathleen Dean Moore's The Extinction Variation, taken from her book, The Earth's Wild Music, with the accompaniment of Rachel McCabe. And this will be about the sorrow of the loss of meadowlarks.